אתם עם SBS בעברית. לעוד סיפורים מעניינים, כנסו ל-sbs.com.au.
Welcome, Joel Lazar, to SBS Hebrew.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Joel, why a Jewish climate network?
The theory behind it is based on good social science, which is basically that groups of people always need trusted messengers to help inspire and motivate them to kind of do anything in the world. It's been a long time when the environmental movement used more, I guess, universalist messages around, you know, save the planet and nature, all very high level kind of concepts. But the idea that we need people who are like us, who have similar histories, similar experiences, is well established. So the Jewish Climate Network was founded to kind of plug that hole in the Jewish community's networks, where we didn't have an established, known, well-trusted organization and voice that understood all the intricacies of the Jewish experience and could effectively weave in climate information, climate solutions, programs and initiatives into all of the frameworks that already existed in our community. So JCN came along, it exists to do just that.
So who established the JCN?
JCN was founded by a group of Jewish community leaders in Victoria who all came from diverse backgrounds. Investors and entrepreneurs and the head of the Jewish Museum and our security group and a Jewish school, all coming from different backgrounds, but all kind of united around the idea that the Jewish community had huge potential to be a leader in this space and use all of its unique strengths and attributes to contribute to this big fight. And yeah, they came together and set up this organization, and they started running climate conversations in people's homes where someone would just invite, say, 10, 15 of your friends or family, put on a bit of herring, a drink, create a really nice kind of safe, comfortable environment. That's kind of the environment that a lot of people needed and still need to feel like they can ask all those really hard questions about this big issue. And everything kind of flowed from there.
So you basically wanted to leverage your mission by participating in this group and using your unique selling point as being Jewish. So that would bring people in, and then working your way up from there. Do you think that's more effective than just joining other climate change groups?
I think it's really quite particular to every person. You know, some community members feel especially deeply connected to the Jewish community, their heritage, their traditions, and they love to kind of operate within that framework and wear their Jewish hat, so to speak, when they're doing social change work. Others feel as equally connected to their universal self or their human side, and they're kind of happy to join any climate group. So for those members of the community who are happy to do that, I just say Gesundheit, like good luck, go do that, find that group that meets your needs. And if for whatever reason what's out there doesn't meet your needs, well, JCN is here to kind of weave in the Jewish aspects to the climate work that you want to do.
I guess that people don't really want to abandon their Jewish values whilst joining a civic advocacy group like yours. I heard you once quote Sir David Attenborough by saying that climate change isn't a scientific problem, it's a communications problem. Can you elaborate on that?
The science has been known for decades. I don't know the exact year, but it was presented in the United States Senate by some of their chief scientists. It might have been in the 70s, I might have got that wrong. But it's been around for a really long time, and yet here we are. Like, you know, fossil fuels are still being used at record volumes, and temperatures are higher than they've ever been. So clearly we're not doing something right, even though we've known the science for a very long time. The reason I think Sir David Attenborough said that was that we haven't yet translated the physical scientific reality to why should I do something about it in my own personal life, in my home, in my business, and also, will what I do make a difference? That question is like a question of perception. It's a story, and it's a communications issue about can something that is so big be impacted upon by someone who's just an individual? And so I think that's what Attenborough is getting at, and I wholeheartedly agree. You know, there's bits around the edges on the science that, of course, we still need to work on around causation between rising temperatures and specific types of weather events and how bad can they get and things like that. But the crux of it is already known. And so we just got to kind of get out there and inspire people to feel like they can make a difference, which they can.
The subject of climate change is so amorphous and elusive, and it's actually quite intimidating to many people simply because of the amount of data and even the verbiage that people aren't really acquainted with. In light of that, can you please tell us a little bit about global warming or an example of what the benefits of recycling are, or you just mentioned before fossil fuels? I mean, these words are said again and again, and yet people don't even know what they mean.
That's part of what JCN exists to do, and I would hope lots of other climate organisations are out there to kind of explain all the core concepts, because there are a lot of concepts, but it's actually also very simple. So, I mean, I could try and explain the whole thing in, you know, a minute or two. The best analogy I have for it is a person lying in a bed and there's a blanket on them, right? And if that blanket is a nice thickness, it's a relatively nice temperate day, you'll feel nice and comfortable. But keep laying blankets on top, more and more and more blankets. And obviously, you know what happens, right? You feel boiling underneath. You start to sweat. Temperature rises. That's basically global heating. The blanket is gases that are surrounding our planet. There have historically, for hundreds of thousands of years, been just the right amount of gases to foster this incredible natural world that we live in. The gases would allow just enough heat from the sun to come into our atmosphere and create the perfect conditions, and just enough to escape so that it didn't get too hot, didn't get too cold. But fossil fuels, coal, oil, and gas, when we burn them to run this amazing civilization and society that we live in, the byproduct is layers and layers of blankets going around the Earth. And what the science, the physical science tells us is that as the planetary system gets hotter and hotter underneath that blanket, it leads to more frequent and more intense extreme weather events, more floods, more cyclones, more fires, more extreme heat days. That's the link between global heat rising and extreme weather events. And so what the big task that humanity is kind of on right now is to lower the temperature of the planet so that we lower the frequency and intensity of extreme weather events, which are increasingly killing people, destroying lives, societies, etc. And the big misconception that a lot of people have, which I find it very important to correct, is the kind of 1.5 degree, 2 degree thing that you might have heard, a lot of people listening might have heard. It doesn't sound like very much. Right, 1.5 degrees. The science basically tells us that the average temperature of the planet was X before the Industrial Revolution. I know we're getting into history here. Then the Industrial Revolution came about and there was this massive proliferation of energy. We started to burn fossil fuels to create the amazing societies that we live in, and that started to raise the temperature of the planet. And so what the scientists have come to in the last kind of decade or two is that we can't raise the temperatures more than 1.5 degrees since what they were in the Industrial Revolution, since those times. Right. And if we do, every fraction of a degree above 1.5 will greatly increase the chance of extreme weather, of coral bleaching, extreme weather events, et cetera, et cetera. And those 0.1 degrees matter so much, and they're exactly like a human body, which is carefully calibrated to, you know, 37.5 degrees or whatever it is. And we all know that when we have a temperature, it's not like we're 100 degrees, we're just 38 degrees, we're 39 degrees, and the closer we edge up every 0.1 of a degree, you know, there's risk of brain damage and death. So the planet is also very carefully calibrated in that way. And so right now we're edging up to 1.5 degrees already. That's why people call it a climate crisis or a climate emergency, because time's up, basically. This is the most important decade of the millennium. Everything we can do to keep temperatures as close to 1.5 as possible will save lives, ecosystems, animals, etc.
Is it an achievable target to reverse that sort of damage, or are we too far gone?
That's an open question in the science. There's a phrase called overshoot. There's a debate about if we go over 1.5 degrees or over 2 degrees, can we suck down all of that excess carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that we've emitted over the last 250 years and return back to equilibrium? There's a hope, there's an aspiration that we can in the science. But the only way we're going to be able to do it is to preserve all of the natural ecosystems, as much of it as possible, because our best sucker down of gases in the atmosphere is basically forests and oceans. Oceans absorb huge amounts of heat in the atmosphere. So if we cut down trees and forests unnecessarily, then we don't have nature to store all of that, those gases. And also technology, we're going to need to develop carbon capture and storage technology, which kind of is like a big fan, really, and just sucks all this gas out of the atmosphere. But it's not commercially viable yet. It hasn't been, and we have big hopes that it will be. So we hope, and we have to work hard to get there.
And by working hard, what kind of money sustains your network? Because obviously you need the resources to galvanize people and power.
JCN's funded by philanthropy and donations, so the community kind of keep us going. Yeah, so we don't receive any government funding at the moment.
Is that something you're aiming for?
Community. Not necessarily. I mean, to some extent, the more you take from government, the more you're kind of tied to their positions and things like that. Not always, you know. There's lots of charities out there who receive government grants who still are free and able to critique government policy. So that's still doable. It feels great knowing that the Jewish community are backing our work and funding us as their kind of primary climate action vehicle.
Do you cross-pollinate with any other climate advocacy groups?
Yeah, we're a member of Climate Action Network Australia, CANA. Yeah, we interact with some of the other climate groups from time to time. If there's kind of a strategy or a policy that we both agree on, then we'll collaborate and work on that together. And if not, not everyone in the network. Actually, there's quite a diverse range of theories of change and philosophies among all the climate groups in Australia. So we work with those that we feel have kind of values alignment with us.
What are some of your past achievements with the Climate Network?
Well, there's a lot. In the last sort of 5 years or so since we were founded, we've probably reached about 14,000 Jewish Australians through a range of panels, public programs, downloading of our resources. Annually, we run something called the Climate Shabbat, which is, it's kind of like New York Climate Week, but for Jews. So it's a lot smaller. On that weekend, once a year, we set up panels. Last year, we had sort of 7 panels running around town in different synagogues, and community members are invited to attend the panels and experts on different climate topics that they're interested in. A couple of thousand people go through that. We do that annually. We've run a program with large Jewish community organizations like sporting clubs, synagogues, aged care facilities, to help them understand the sources of their emissions and the potential they have to be a sustainable organization. And that's been really great. Done that in Victoria and New South Wales. And something we're very excited about, which we'll be doing more of, is leaning into leadership training. So identifying really smart, up-and-coming, rising members of the Jewish community in a range of different professions, artistic backgrounds, to take them away for an immersive weekend and put them in front of some of Australia's leading climate experts and inspiring them to go back into their networks and their communities and sub-communities and companies to try to make a difference out there in the world.
How fantastic. So that's not open to the public.
For members of the Jewish community and kind of anyone can apply and sort of take everyone.
It appears as though the Greens are taking custody of this subject as opposed to the Liberal Party or even as opposed to the Labor Party. Explain to me the crux of why it has become such a politicised issue.
Well, there's a few parts to this. The Greens, Bob Brown, you know, was one of the forefathers of the Greens Party, and environmental action was a core philosophy of his and the party early on. And the Greens didn't used to have a multi-platform aspect to their politics. That's something that's a bit more recent, I think, to try to capture more voters in Australia.
That's interesting.
Which makes sense. I mean, it's in their name, right? But Liberal parties overseas, like in the UK, similar country to ours in many respects, climate is not a politicised issue like it is here. And little known facts are that Richard Nixon in the United States, he established the Environmental Protection Agency in the 70s. It wasn't politicized back then. It was seen as a conservation. The word conservation is a similar word to the word conservative and conservative politics, the idea of conserving nature. So it hasn't always been politicized. I think the most common reason given for its politicization in Australia is basically the fossil fuel lobby. The fossil fuel lobby for decades invested millions and millions of dollars in misinformation campaigns through think tanks and their personal lobby groups to try to influence politicians and Australians and their attitudes towards climate action in order to ensure that the status quo was maintained. There's various books about the early days of the relationship between the fossil fuel industry and various politicians and parties. And I think that's kind of it. It's a very sophisticated operation they run. Fossil fuels in Australia has been a big contributor to national income for a long time. Fossil fuel exports have made us billions of dollars, so they're a very powerful industry. I think it was in their interest to sow confusion and doubt and skepticism in the minds of the public, and I think we still feel the effects of that today.
Can you be environmentally aware as much as you are economically aware as an Australian citizen?
Increasingly, absolutely. The way I like to look at it, and there are papers on this, there's good research and evidence on it, is that the cost of inaction is far greater than the cost of action. The top question that people who are economically minded will ask is, how much is this going to cost? how much will it cost to transition our electricity grid to renewable energy and et cetera, electric vehicles, blah, blah, blah. And that is a question, and it will cost billions of dollars to build out the grid and the transmission wires, et cetera, et cetera. But the cost, the insurance costs and the cleanup bills from extreme weather, from destroying entire towns and businesses, is billions and billions and billions and rising. And it'll only go up as the years go on, the slower we go on this transition. So it's 100% a massive economic issue. And to be honest, outside of politics, people who are economically astute have already factored this in for years. It's really surprising that the thinking that economically minded business people have already been doing has not filtered into politics. Insurance companies, actuaries, top ASX listed companies, huge private companies, they're all aware of the physical risks of, say, to properties that are on the coast of Australia, of being smashed by rising sea levels and storms and things like that. And there are maps increasingly being developed around, you know, you can sort of put in your postcode in your suburb and you can see which suburbs are at most risk from extreme weather. It's absolutely an economic question. And to ignore it would be to send Australia down a track of more economic harm as well. I should also say the flip side of that is the economic opportunity. It's not just avoiding economic harm. So right. at the household level, for example, solar panels, batteries, to the extent that they're affordable for a particular household, you can have zero cost electricity bills forever, basically, if you have solar and battery or very close to zero. I think my electricity bill each month of the summer last year was like $11, $12, $6. So over time, you save money by introducing these kind of climate conscious decisions to your life.
Without sounding like a negative Nancy, lots of people would argue that we're a mere blip on the radar when it comes to comparing Australia to, say, countries like China with a population of 1.5 billion people. Why should Australia decrease emissions if larger countries are bigger culprits?
There's two key answers to this one. It's a really good question. It's very common. Firstly, there's a misconception that the large emitters are not doing anything, like China is doing ridiculous amounts around renewable energy and the transition. So part of the importance of, say, the UN climate conversations is around climate finance. It's supporting countries that historically has had less opportunity to develop and supporting them to develop as much as possible. Developed countries have benefited from all of the impacts of fossil fuels for centuries, and our standards of living have risen very quickly and impressively, and countries like India less so. So the obligation is really, it's widely accepted, the obligation is on countries like the G20 to support countries like India to achieve net zero financially. But in terms of Australia's impact as a small power, we account for about 1-2% of total global emissions in terms of the pie, kind of the crude pie. But when you account for the exports, the fossil fuel exports that Australia is accountable for, the coal that we dig out of our ground and the gas that we extract and we send elsewhere to be burnt and used in other countries, our impact is closer to 9%, 7-9% of the global pie, which is significant. So not only do we need to decarbonize to get to zero emissions to account for that 1-2% of the pie, but the faster we can become an exporter of renewable energy to other countries, we can also influence them. And there's this amazing, impressive project in the Northern Territory called Sun Cable, which aims to harvest huge amounts of solar energy from Northern Territory and give a portion of it to the Northern Territory's electricity needs, but then to send that to Singapore as well via a massive undersea cable and help Singapore achieve zero emissions. So as an exporter of energy, we've got this amazing potential to kind of help the world. And then the last bit I would say is really, this is a question around social change in general. When you feel like you're only one small piece of a large thing, what motivates us to do anything? And I think most of us would agree that when something is the right thing to do, it's just the right thing to do. There's this beautiful Jewish line that you're not obliged to complete a task. The task might be huge, but you're also not free to do nothing about it. You need to do the bit that is yours to do.
Do you have any issues trying to mobilize the Jewish community into participating? Do you meet any friction within the community, or do you find that there's a lot of people wanting to get involved with your network?
I think it's both. When I meet resistance, especially now in the last 2 years where the Jewish community has been experiencing a huge amount of hate and rising anti-Semitism, often actually there's a feeling of kind of we have bigger fish to fry, or like we're in an existential crisis right now as a community. When this passes, hopefully it passes soon, we'll have the opportunity to focus on bigger national and global things like climate, which I totally understand. Any community that felt like it was under siege would probably react similarly. The community is not monolithic, so it's not like we all think one thing at any given point in time. So I'm finding that as the weeks and months pass, there are people who step in and step out and participate how they feel they can, then they take a break. I think it's actually like that in climate, with climate in general, like people who are parts of other climate groups, they might work on this intensively for 6 months, a couple of years, and then feel like I need a break from this. It's all kind of a lot. I'm going to go on holiday, take a sabbatical, maybe even change jobs for a while, and then they come back. So that's the nature of it.
And last question, I just want to ask about you. Did you always know that you wanted to get involved in an advocacy group like this or in climate change? Or did you always know that you were going to get involved in some civic duty? How did you get into this?
I started in corporate law and commercial litigation. That had nothing to do with this. It was just a great kind of place to start my career and learn about business and risk and a lot of important things that make the world go round. I grew up in a Jewish community that was always very civically minded, that cared about social justice, making the world a better place. And I went to a youth group, like the Jewish community have these different youth groups that are kind of leadership hubs for young Jews, I suppose. The youth group that I went to always invited us to look to the broader world and Australian society to make it a better place. But as I kind of got to my second year of law practice, I was thinking, you know, there's more for me to do. I don't feel like my potential is really being activated. I did a creative writing major at uni, like next to my law degree, and studied philosophy and theology. And like, there's always this huge part of myself that just wasn't being used. It was just kind of sitting in the closet. And so I moved into working on young men's mental health issues through another charity, actually, after law. Did that for a few years. I didn't have any climate or environment background specifically. And I think that's the power of JCN is the fact that and the team that we've assembled and our board is that we come from the Jewish community. That's the power of it. It's not that we're rusted on environmentalists for decades. So we really understand the issues and challenges that the community faces. So 5 or 6 years ago, I just dove deeper into the science. Yeah, it's mostly our board and our advisory board and the incredible network of experts that are around JCN that helped educate me and bring me up to scratch on what the latest problem is, what the solutions are. And yeah, I'm kind of constantly learning every day, really. It's a fast evolving area.
Joel, thank you so much for joining us on SBS Hebrew.
So good to be here. Thanks for having me.
רוצים לשמוע עוד סיפורים? האזינו דרך האפל פודקאסט, גוגל פודקאסט, ספוטיפיי, או בכל מקום אחר בו ניתן להזין לפודקאסטים.